fact is, there are technologies in the world today that even 5 years ago didn't exist at all, and that could have a tremendous benefit for people that we are trying to reach, the most vulnerable people in the world, those who are furthest behind.
The technology behind the digital currency Bitcoin is helping humanitarians to save lives and money in the Middle East. I'm Deanne Penn at the United Nations. Welcome to the latest episode of our podcast, The Lid is On. This time around, we're looking at how technology and innovation are driving UN efforts to end hunger by 2030.
When we see technology in our part of the world, the rich part of the world, technologies that are developed with a commercial perspective, for example, having extremely sophisticated systems behind, whether it's something like Uber or grocery delivery, we've seen the life-changing impacts of those technologies. The way that we do things is different than it was before. If you consider that those benefits are being had in this part of the world, what difference in livelihoods or in lives could it make to the people who are furthest behind?
That's Robert Opp, Director of the Innovation and Change Management Division at the World Food Programme. WFP is the leading humanitarian organization fighting hunger, assisting 80 million people in about 80 countries each year. On any given day, WFP trucks, ships, and planes are on the move, delivering food and other aid to people in need. And now the UN agency is using blockchain, the technology behind the cryptocurrency Bitcoin, to ensure thousands of Syrian refugees in Jordan get enough to eat. Blockchain is like an online ledger that allows financial information to be transmitted securely, and it can be applied to other sectors. WFP is using it to provide the refugees with digital cash vouchers so they can buy food for their families. The money for the vouchers comes from donors, and because blockchain assures security, all transactions throughout the entire process can be monitored. It's also cost-effective, another bonus. This is just one example of how WFP is applying high-tech solutions to address one of the world's most pressing problems. But, as Mr. Opp told me, when it comes to stamping out hunger, innovation comes in many forms.
It's actually not only technology. We're interested in all sorts of new ways of doing things, new approaches. So it could actually be an innovation in a business model, or it can be something very low-tech. For example, business model innovation would involve, for example, our post-harvest loss project, which is working with 250,000 farmers, small farmers in Eastern Africa, to provide them with a partially subsidized silo, which is very low-tech, together with training and really some sort of basic level of organization to allow them to ensure that their harvest is not spoiled because it's being stored properly. This is something that all the pieces existed before, but the way we've put the project together was an innovation in itself. So it's a different kind of business model to use.
And from the low-tech to the high-tech as well, though.
Absolutely.
And speaking of that, I understand you're doing some work with blockchain. I've only heard about it in the context of cryptocurrencies,
right,
like Bitcoin, but maybe you can just break that down for us.
Sure. So we are interested in also technology and the application of technology, because the fact is there are technologies in the world today that even 5 years ago didn't exist at all, and that could have a tremendous benefit for people that we are trying to reach, the most vulnerable people in the world, those who are furthest behind. And so when we look at technology, it's with the problems that we have in mind that we see at the field level and how those technologies, the new things coming out of Silicon Valley or New York or London or Nairobi or wherever they are, how those technologies can really be brought to bear on the challenge of global hunger. And so technologies like, for example, artificial intelligence, we are looking at how artificial intelligence could be applied to the way that we are using satellite images and drone images, for example, in a post-shock situation when we want to see what the situation is on the ground. We're able to use, for example, artificial intelligence machine reading to automatically interpret the imagery, to do object recognition, to be able to say, this many houses have been destroyed, this many bridges are down, because previously we would have to do that all manually. Also, artificial intelligence can give us the ability to reach people almost on a one-to-one basis using chatbots, which are being commonly used in other industries right now for customer service as a means of hearing more voices, because people could actually interact with a computer and we can understand more about the challenges that they face, but also make sure that we're broadcasting information to them. So really establishing a two-way feedback channel. And then to come to your question about blockchain. essentially blockchain technology, which of course is the technology that was invented in order to support the Bitcoin concept. It's a distributed ledger. So it is a very secure means of establishing trust between two counterparties without necessarily the use of a third-party intermediary, because the technology really provides a very secure kind of assurance that the information that you're transmitting is actually what it is and the counterparties are who they are. And it does that by sharing the information across multiple nodes so that it's virtually impossible to hack or change the entries once they've been recorded. So we've been looking at that technology. Well, we've actually implemented it as the payment process for one of our digital voucher programs in Jordan, reaching Syrian refugees. We're reaching them with assistance through what we call a digital voucher program. It's a cash entitlement. They can go to any retailer that they want in the immediate region, and they're able to purchase food commodities with this entitlement. Previously, what would happen is that after they've been registered as refugees by the High Commission for Refugees, we receive the list of names, and then we receive, obviously, the funds from donors to support the program. We would pass the lists of people plus the funds to a local financial service provider who would create wallets for each of the families, and then they would track and reconcile all the payments. With blockchain, we're able to do the tracking and reconciliation ourselves because it has such a strong and transparent data trail. And so what we see is an increase in the security of the program because we don't have to send information about people's identities and funds to a third party. We're also seeing an increase in transparency. So if there's any sort of strange transactions or things going on, we're able to really trace that back very easily and audit what has gone on. And in the case of Jordan, we're also seeing a cost efficiency. We're saving at the moment about 1.5% in terms of the overall transactions going to people, which at the moment in the program, which is reaching 100,000 refugees, amounts to about $30,000 to $40,000 a month in savings. We don't always think the savings will be as great or as easy. It depends on the operational setup of the program. But we're looking to how we expand across Jordan. So we plan to have about 500,000 people under this system by the end of the year. And we're also looking at other applications of blockchain, such as our supply chain, our physical supply chain for the World Food Program, and other things, even how we can support our school feeding programs with governments and things in Tunisia and so on.
Are beneficiaries a part of the developments that you're making?
One of the things that we created to support innovations across the organization is an innovation accelerator that is physically located in Munich, Germany. It operates with funding from the government of Germany. And what the accelerator has a staff of people that are skilled in how to support innovation. So a lot of them have been serial entrepreneurs. Some of them have worked in tech startup accelerators in different parts of the world. And some of them are experts in things like human-centered design, which is a sort of concept that's really come out of the tech world over the last several years. And when we approach any particular innovation, we partner with someone else in the organization that's working at it. So it could be somebody at the country level in one of our 82 country offices. It could be a functional area in headquarters. But the way we approach it is that we work together with those teams and the people who will ultimately reach. For example, we're building an app that connects Syrian refugees in Lebanon to give them more information about the retail spots where they can maximize their cash entitlement in terms of food purchases. We actually work with the people who are going to use that in a very iterative, fast cycle of testing a minimum product, if we call it a minimum viable product first, and then build that out into something that is more like the final product, but testing every single time with the people who are going to be actually be using it, so the end user. So these are the kind of methodologies that we've essentially lifted from other industries, and now we're applying to the aid industry and saying these things can have value when we're designing solutions to our problems.
You know, we're now in this period for achieving the Sustainable Development Goals, one of which, of course, is ending hunger. What other developments or what other hopes do you have going forward before we get to 2030 that you'd like to see so that we do reach that goal?
Well, I think that obviously reaching the Sustainable Development Goals are tall order. It's a big challenge. And the fact is, when we look at the goal related to ending hunger, We will not reach zero hunger by 2030 at our current rate of progress. This is one of the reasons we are interested in innovation. It's not the only thing that's going to accelerate our progress, but we believe it can be one of the things that accelerates our progress. And so I'm quite hopeful that in terms of the innovation space, we will see a new ability to create programs that will reach people more effectively based on some of the big trends that are going to affect the entire world. One of those trends is the penetration of mobile technologies and increasingly smartphones with people all around the world who will be able to access internet at virtually zero cost. And the devices will eventually become quite low cost as well. And we're seeing this in happening an adoption rate of these technologies at a much higher pace than I think anyone of us would have predicted 5 years ago. What that means is that an increasing number of the people that we reach, even the furthest behind, will in the next 5 to 8 years have access to this kind of mobile connectedness. And there's a lot of programming that we can think about how to reach people using platforms like that to increase the effectiveness of what we do now, or even reimagine the way that we're reaching people. So mobile connectedness is one of those. Artificial intelligence is another, which I've already mentioned, which I think is really a game changer when it comes to how we're able to use massive amounts of information and data that will be collected. And by analyzing that data, start to understand more about what works and what doesn't in terms of our programs, which is really important because we can't afford to be doing things that don't have maximum effectiveness. And so, I think there are going to be a lot of changes in the world at a pace that's faster than we probably can predict right now. And we need to make sure that as the United Nations, we are agile enough and responsive enough to embrace those technologies and those changes in order to benefit those who are furthest behind. That's the fundamental role that I think we have an obligation to play.
Mr. Opp, thank you for speaking to us. And just one final question. You mentioned the people that you work with, you know, they have entrepreneurial backgrounds, tech backgrounds. They left that sector to come to the UN. You yourself were in the private sector. But why is it so important? Or what was the catalyst for you to take up this kind of work? I mean, you could have gone anywhere.
Pure and simple, working in the United Nations, particularly and in where I've worked in the World Food Program, I see a lot of impact that can come as a result of the work that we do. And we work at a scale and a level of impact that is difficult to find in virtually any other industry. When you have somebody who is affected by hunger and you're able to kind of make sure that the assistance you're providing is helping them not only in the immediate short term, but also to build livelihoods or rebuild livelihoods depending on what's happened, this is a sort of a reward feedback loop that is far greater than what you find in most private sector companies or industries. And so I think what drives me and my team is this sense that we are able to have impact at a scale that is really going to make a difference. And that's absolutely what's kept me in the organization for as long as I've been there.
Mr. Opp, thank you for speaking to us. Is there any final message you'd like to leave with us or anything that we did not discuss that you would like, this is your last chance,
yeah.
Just in case?
I think just one thing. I kind of alluded to it before. When we see technology in our part of the world, so, you know, the rich part of the world, technologies that are developed with a commercial perspective, for example, having extremely sophisticated systems behind, whether it's something like Uber or grocery delivery or whatever it is, we've seen the life-changing impact of those technologies. The way that we do things is different than it was before. Mm-hmm. If you consider that those benefits are being had in this part of the world, what difference in livelihoods or in lives could it make to the people who are furthest behind? That marginal difference is way higher for people who are underserved, who are most vulnerable. And so I think one of the things that is the most interesting to me is, how do we take those technologies and adopt them and new business models for how to offer the benefits of that technology at a lower cost or a accessible cost for people all around the world? In other words, spread the benefits much more evenly. And I think there's a business case to be made for that, but there's also a case that organizations like the UN need to take a role in helping private industry understand how to adapt those business models. So that's really a key dynamic that I look at a lot.
That was Robert Opp, Director of the Innovation and Change Management Division at the World Food Programme, WFP. By the way, his team was also behind the award-winning app Share the Meal. Perhaps you've heard of it. Share the Meal lets the average person donate money to WFP by simply tapping on their smartphone. And we're not talking huge amounts here. Donations can be as small as 50 cents, and that's enough to feed one hungry child for a day. And that brings us to the end of this episode of The Lid Is On. I'm Deanne Penn at the United Nations in New York. Thanks for listening.